Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Marty Walsh faced an apparently friendly Senate confirmation hearing today after placing the brand new police commissioner on leave last night pending an investigation. We will talk about all of that a little later in the show. But first, Massachusetts Congressman and Chair of the House Rules Committee, Jim McGovern, is with us. Today, Rules asked the House to strip a Republican colleague of her committee seats after Republicans refused to do it themselves. It is one of several unilateral decisions or actions that Democrats appear ready to take. Congressman McGovern, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Happy to be with you.
So there's so much for us to talk about. I do just want to start by getting your reactions to the fact that it appears Marty Walsh had a smooth confirmation hearing today. Obviously, there's more time before the vote. But what would his confirmation as Labor Secretary mean for us here in the Commonwealth, do you think?
Well, first of all, I'm delighted that he received a warm reception in the United States Senate. He deserves to. He's been an excellent mayor, and he'll be an excellent Secretary of Labor. I mean, what it means for Massachusetts is that working people will have a strong voice in Washington. I mean, he is an ally of labor. He will fight to make sure that people earn a living wage. He understands the importance of workers having access to health care and to pensions. So I'm really excited about it, and I think he'll do a great job, and I expect he will be confirmed overwhelmingly.
All right, let's go to the People's House now. You and your hot colleagues there took up a measure today to strip Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of her committee appointments. You advanced the resolution as chair of the Rules Committee. Why?
Because I think there has to be a response to the hate and to the violent rhetoric that she has espoused for, you know, not just a few years back, but recently as well. I mean, you know, she has advocated and endorsed language calling for a bullet to the head of Speaker Pelosi. She has talked about trying members of Congress for treason and having them executed. She has claimed that the terrible school shootings at Sandy Hook and Parkland were fake, were set up. She denied 9/11 happened. I mean, I'd go on and on and on. You know, she shared a video on her social media of a Holocaust denier, saying some of the most anti-Semitic things possible. But the bottom line is, this is somebody who has advocated that members of Congress be assassinated or executed. And being on a committee is a privilege. It's not a right. And I, you know, in the past, we have denied committees to people like Congressman Steve King of Iowa, who embraced white supremacism. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene is worse than Steve King.
So, Congressman, I want to point a couple of things out and play some sound for you. On the floor today, she acknowledged that 9/11 happened. She said she regretted her remarks and they were from the past. I want to play you a piece of another thing she said today. Here she is.
And if this Congress is to tolerate members that condone riots that have hurt American people, attacked police officers, occupied federal property, burned businesses and cities, but yet wants to condemn me and crucify me in the public square for words that I said and I regret a few years ago, then I think we are in a real big problem.
So two things there. One, your response to her walking back of those things today. And two, the underlying threat there and concern that there could be a tit for tat, that this sets precedence for others in the future when Republicans are empowered to strip others of committees based on things they've said in social media.
So she finally admitted that 9/11 occurred, but she didn't really walk anything else back. She didn't apologize for any of the violent rhetoric, you know, the bullet to the head comments or any of that stuff. And she equated the American media with QAnon, which is a violent cult. And she, you know, she comes up with these false equivalencies. I mean, the bottom line is the standard and the precedent that we are setting today is that if there's a member in this chamber who advocates assassinating other members, you know what, they don't deserve to be on committees. The voters of Georgia can vote to send her here if they want. But those of us in this chamber who serve, you know, have an obligation to make sure that we uphold a high standard in terms of conduct. You know, while she's giving that speech, she was fundraising. Basically doubling down on her past remarks, saying, "I won't back down." So, look, I mean, this was not a speech of contrition. This was basically trying to say that, I'm a nice person, so don't do this to me. But I mean, she, on her social media, she says the words, "We will not back down. We will never give up." And again, what she has said is so far beyond the pale that we need to respond. If we don't respond, then the implication is that we're all okay with this. Well, I'm not okay with it. We'll find out whether a majority of my colleagues are okay with it.
I want to bring this back home now, because there's a lot of business before Congress this year that's going to be really relevant to the people of Massachusetts. This is what appears from the outside to be a pretty pitched battle between Democrats and Republicans around who is being held accountable for what. Are you able, while this stuff is going on, to also enact the business of Congress with Republican colleagues, or are we seeing a kind of scorched earth that's just going to put everything on the back burner for 2021?
We can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can demand accountability for what happened here on January 6th. We can demand accountability from people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, and we can still do people's business. We are moving forward with a COVID relief package and an economic stimulus package, and we are trying to work with Republicans to try to get some of their buy-in on this, on what we're doing. But we're not going to nickel and dime these things to the point where they're ineffective. So we are trying to work in a bipartisan way. President Biden has met with Republican senators. I mean, we continue to consult with them to try to get their ideas. But at the end of the day, I mean, the president made a promise in this election, and that was he's going to crush this virus and help get this economy back on its feet. And that's what he's going to do. And so we are moving a budget reconciliation bill through the House and the Senate so that we can preserve that as an option, so we can pass a budget with a majority of votes. We don't need 60 votes, and so we're working on that as we speak. All the committees of jurisdiction are trying to figure out how we can help this economy and help crush this virus.
You know, we talked to your colleague in the Massachusetts delegation, Stephen Lynch, earlier this week about that bill as well, the COVID relief package. He basically said there might be room for bipartisan agreement, but happy to go forward without it if that's necessary to get this done. We know there's been basically a $1.3 trillion gap between President Biden's proposal and the offer by 10 Senate Republicans, but that the president did signal that he might move toward Republicans on how targeted the $1,400 stimulus payments are. Is there a path to getting a bill passed there by both parties that provides real relief to the American people? And what's lost if it has to be done through a procedure instead of getting it passed?
Yeah. Well, look, the American people elected a Democratic majority in the Senate and a Democratic president because they believe in bold action. They want somebody to deal with this pandemic and solve our economic crisis. And they believe, I'm looking at polls overwhelmingly, that President Biden's American Rescue Plan is good for the country. I think like 74%. They understand that this is real. And so we're ready to work with Republicans, but we're not going to let them, stall and delay this relief package. Time is of the essence. And, if there are ideas like maybe targeting some of the relief in a better way, I think the president said he's open to that. But there's a big difference between, what the number in terms of what the president has proposed and what the Republicans are proposing. So we need to pass something that will be effective. And people are expecting a bill that will be effective. They're not looking for a bill that has, a Republican co-sponsor. They're looking for a bill that will help solve the crisis that we're facing right now. And my hope is that Republicans will join with us on this. If that happens, I will be the first to applaud it. But I've seen Mitch McConnell in action before, and I've seen Kevin McCarthy in action before. We're not going to let them nickel and dime this down to the point where it's meaningless. We need real relief, and we need it now.
And you feel like the majority of the American people will be comfortable with a going-it-alone approach by Democrats, despite President Biden's bipartisanship message, if that's what's necessary to get things done. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
President Biden is sitting down with the Republicans, listening to their ideas, and I'm sure that some of their ideas will be included in this bill. But, you know, when I go home, you know, when I talk to restaurant owners who are looking for help so that they don't go out of business, when I talk to families that are struggling, they're not saying, well, you know, make sure that whatever the bill is has Mitch McConnell's approval. What they're looking for is something real. And the American people voted for the American Rescue Package. In essence, when they voted for Biden and voted for a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate, we're going to move that forward. If we can accommodate Republican ideas, we will do that. But again, the issue that we should be focused on is, you know, we need to make sure we pass something that is effective, that is going to solve the problems that we're confronted. And I think that's, yeah, that's what I'm focused on. And my hope is that Republicans will support us on this.
You just mentioned struggling families, restaurant owners, small businesses here in the Commonwealth. We talked with you in November about spiking hunger. You know, right. You're talking about this relief package. We are still in it with the pandemic. Right. Is this going to be a year of hunger in the Commonwealth? And what do you do about it?
Yeah, well, one is we need to pass this relief package because it will increase benefits for people on SNAP. It will provide more money for food banks. It'll provide more money for struggling businesses so they don't have to close off. So that will all be helpful. But we have a hunger problem in this country. We talked about this before in your show, as you mentioned. And that hunger problem existed even before this pandemic. So I'm pushing this president to appoint a hunger czar or a food czar who can help coordinate these efforts in the federal government. And I'm also asking them to do a White House conference on food, nutrition, and hunger. We need a comprehensive, holistic plan to deal with this issue. We don't have one. We have lots of programs. All of them do good things. But we need to connect all the dots so that we can move forward to solve hunger once and for all. So I'm hungered by, you know, some of the things that President Biden has done in terms of supporting increased SNAP benefits. He's already increased the benefits by 15% for families with kids. And these people get real money in their pockets. And he's rolling back some of the Trump administrative rules that restrict eligibility. So we're making some steps in the right direction. But we need a comprehensive, holistic plan to tackle hunger. And I'm going to continue to pressure this administration to make sure that this is one of their priorities.
That is Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern, who represents the 2nd District. Congressman, I know it's a busy day there today. Thanks for your time.
It's always good talking with you.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is in the nation's capital today. He had his confirmation hearing to be President Joe Biden's labor secretary. Here is Mayor Walsh earlier today touting his record running the city of Boston for the last 7 years.
For the past 7 years, I've had the honor of serving as mayor of my hometown, Boston, Massachusetts. We've proven that we can create a world-class economy that works for working people. We secured a $15 an hour minimum wage. We expanded workplace training. We created groundbreaking policies to close gender wage gaps and increase racial equity. And businesses thrived as well.
Jim Puzangera is the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, and he is here to tell us more about what happened. Jim, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jim, was it a friendly hearing?
Yeah, it was. I mean, Marty Walsh did not have a good night last night with the news about the Boston Police Commissioner Dennis White and having to put him on leave, but he had a good day today. He was treated very friendly, cruised through his confirmation hearing. Democrats obviously were thrilled with his nomination. They particularly praised his background as a former union president. He'll be the first labor secretary in decades with that in his background. And Republicans, even though they sparred a bit with him over things like increasing the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour, expanding collective bargaining rights, they pretty much agreed that he was a good choice and said that they looked forward to working with him. So all in all, a successful run through a nomination hearing, which is pretty much the big hurdle for a nominee is getting through one of those.
So, Jim, you mentioned what happened last night with Police Commissioner Dennis White. We're going to talk about that next here on the show. Did that come up today? Did Marty Walsh have to address it?
No, it did not come up. No one asked him about it. You know, a little surprising maybe, but, you know, a lot of these senators prepared their questions probably yesterday ahead of time. The hearing was this morning. They may not have been aware of it. Nobody asked about it. So that was
could it come up? I mean, there's time before a vote, right?
Yeah, conceivably it could come up. I don't know that it would be a major stumbling block for him. You know, it's obviously it's not a good sign him having to do that. But overall, if you look at his body of work as mayor of Boston and look at his background for being labor secretary, I don't know that it would cause a problem for his nomination based on his entire, you know, body of work.
All right, Jim, if one went in fresh today, didn't know anything, listened to the hearing, what would one come out saying, okay, Marty Walsh as labor secretary means X?
You'd say Marty Walsh as labor secretary means that workers and worker rights are going to be a top priority. I mean, he stressed his union background, the importance of unions to him and his family. A lot of people are probably familiar with the fact that his parents emigrated from Ireland and his father became a laborer in the laborers union in Boston. And Walsh attributes that to the family's ability to get into the middle class. So he talked a lot about the importance of unions. He went out of his way to talk about the importance of frontline workers during the pandemic, particularly mentioning grocery store employees, nurses, ambulance drivers, custodians, and talked about collective bargaining, the need to raise the minimum wage, the need to increase workplace safety, particularly with people going back because of the pandemic. So he talked a lot about workers and worker rights and did not really talk about business, business-friendly environment. He said he touted his ability to collaborate with business and bring business into Boston, but most of what he talked about were workers. And I think that would be the big takeaway, that you have this focus, whereas under the Trump administration, there was more of a focus on making sure labor laws were more business-friendly.
Yeah.
I think Marty Walsh is going to make them more worker-friendly.
And Jim, just briefly, when will a vote happen?
Soon. It's a little unclear. At the end of the hearing, the chairwoman, Patty Murray, said that she was committed to getting a vote as soon as possible. The top Republican on the committee said he would work with her to expedite a committee vote. That probably wouldn't happen until next week. And then he has to sort of line up on the runway with the other nominees ahead of him, cabinet nominees, to get confirmed by the Senate, which is going to be sidetracked to a certain extent or to a great extent by the Trump impeachment trial starting next week.
All right. Jim Pusingera, who is the D.C. bureau chief for the Boston Globe. Jim, thanks. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
All right. So we just talked about this as Mayor Walsh was preparing for his hearing. He may have prepped some new questions because yesterday he put newly appointed Boston Police Commissioner Dennis White on administrative leave pending an investigation. That is after allegations surfaced of domestic violence. Walsh named White to the post just last Thursday after White's predecessor, William Gross, abruptly announced he'd retire the next day. White officially took over Monday. So what is going on? In a few minutes, we want to take your calls. So start dialing now with your questions. What do you make of the news about Boston Police Commissioner Dennis White? What does this say about transparency and accountability in the city's police department and government? What's it going to mean for police reform? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's get an update on what's going on from WBUR's Deborah Becker. Hey there, Deb.
Hi there.
So, Deb, tell us about these allegations and how serious they are.
Well, the domestic violence allegations are outlined in a police report in White's divorce documents. So that report shows that White's ex-wife, who was also a Boston police officer, sought a restraining order back in 1999, alleging that White pushed her and hit her. She also said that White told an acquaintance of theirs that he, quote, wanted to shoot her. The documents also say that White's 17-year-old daughter at the time said she was afraid because her father told her not to startle him because he sleeps with a gun under his pillow. Now, in other court papers, White disputed those allegations and pointed to documents where his wife said there was no physical abuse during their marriage. But the restraining order was issued. White was ordered to stay away from his home and his children for a time. He also had to surrender his service weapon. We haven't found any records of criminal charges against him. And, of course, when the Globe found out about this and asked Mayor Walsh about these allegations that came out in the restraining order, Walsh placed White on leave, and Walsh issued a statement saying, quote, "These disturbing issues were not known to me or my staff, but should have been at the forefront."
How were they not known?
Well, that's a good question. It's hard to believe they were not known. White's ex-wife was a Boston police officer at the time, so he had two police officers in the same department. Also, as I said, White had to surrender his gun as a condition of the restraining order, so presumably his supervisor would have had to have been alerted to that fact. I also spoke with a current Boston police officer today who said that these allegations were known throughout the department, and many were questioning how White was chosen for the commissioner's post and whether this history would eventually become public.
To that question of how he was chosen, there was no search. This was fast last week. Would a search potentially have avoided this situation?
Well, presumably, right? Presumably a more thorough vetting process would have turned this up beforehand. I did talk about this with some folks today, including Chuck Wexler, who's executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum. Now, that's a police think tank based in Washington that helps cities with their police searches. He actually helped in Boston when the late Mayor Menino held a national search and chose Ed Davis as his commissioner. So Wexler, also another Boston connection here, interestingly, once worked for the Boston police, said each city handles how it chooses its chief differently. Some conduct big nationwide searches with large committees, and others are like Boston. They do it by mayoral appointment, and it can happen rather quickly. And Wexler said, though, with increased scrutiny on police, especially after last year's killing of George Floyd and the protests over policing and racism, he says cities like Boston should really be careful and consider how they select leaders in their police departments in particular, and those leaders should have their background scrutinized. Let's listen.
Every city is going to be different. I do think going forward that should be part of it. I mean, it's a cautionary tale. That is something to look going into the future, is to just to really review, you know, someone's past, even if they come from within a department.
And Wexler also said that with the new police reforms in Boston that were passed last year, the city should be working with a diverse group and really strongly identify where it is now and where it wants to be in the next few years.
So any information at this point, Deb, also on why William Gross, White's predecessor, left so abruptly, have we heard?
No, and Gross hasn't commented on White being placed on leave either. When Gross announced his retirement last week, both he and Mayor Walsh said Gross was leaving to spend more time with his family. And we should also mention that White served as superintendent and chief of staff under Gross.
So what happens now, and who's in charge while it happens?
Well, the mayor has appointed Superintendent-in-Chief Gregory Long to serve as acting chief for now. And today, the city announced who it hired to conduct an independent investigation, and that is Attorney Tasman Kaplan of Davis Malm. And the city, a statement from the mayor's office said, quote, "We expect this process to be full, impartial, and expedient."
So, Deb, I know you're going to stay with us. We're going to add another voice and start taking calls at 800-423-8255. Also joining us now is Marie St. Fleur, a former Massachusetts state representative, now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Marie served on the Boston Police Reform Task Force, as did Commissioner Dennis White. Marie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tatiana. Good to be with you.
So, Maria, I'm just going to start by asking you your reaction to what's going on.
Well, I was surprised like everyone else. Honestly, I am sad for Superintendent White. I've had the opportunity over the past, during the summer, to get to know Superintendent White. I found him to be a credible individual who was committed to listening and implementing the reforms that we discussed. And so I was quite surprised to wake up this morning to the news that we are all listening. But I gotta say, I'm also concerned that, you know, there's a systemic, besides we could reduce it to Superintendent White. My concern is that an individual's career is on the balance because of a 21-year-old allegation, not a conviction, not a charge, but an allegation. So that to me is problematic. Particularly, it's an individual who actually has been promoted. And the allegation we're talking about was around when he was in the force for 11 years. He's been in the force for 32. And he's been promoted during that period and in leadership positions. So I don't think this raises an issue, not so much about Superintendent White or Commissioner White, but really about what we talked about during the summer, is transparency and accountability in the police department. And it just, in my mind, that's an issue that we dealt with, particularly the OPAT, which we really fought to have implemented and which the city council has adopted. And so I have to say, yeah, so that is.
So I feel like that cuts both ways, though, because also, as Deb and I were just discussing, how did we get to a point where, from a transparency standpoint, no one knew about these allegations ever? They never came forward. They never came up. Do you see a problem with that?
Well, I think that I have a couple of problems with that. I don't know if no one knew about it. Obviously, somebody knew about it enough to give it for it to be in the paper today. That there was also, the reason why we're reading about this, right, is the fact that the Globe has elevated. The reality is it's been sitting in some, there was, as I understand it, there was no complaint, a charge against him, but there was a restraining order that was on file back in 1999. There was a divorce that occurred and there were paperwork from that divorce. So that seems to be what we're reading. That is the basis of the conversation that we're having today. We don't know what happened internally and we don't know whether or not there was any kind of action that was taken internally. So that is what I'm saying, is that if there's a transparency, it's a systemic issue that we need to be looking at. And while it's fine to look at this individual and use that individual as the example, perhaps there's a larger issue that needs to be addressed about the transparency and the accountability. And that's what we were working on those 4 months that we spent this summer looking at the issue. And in my mind, if we're going to look at Commissioner, then we should need to go back and open the window a little bit wider to take a look at this issue. If we believe, and we know that domestic violence is wrong, it shouldn't matter whether you're the commissioner or whether or not you are a patrolman. That should not be an issue that's tolerated and should be vetted. And therefore, we should open the door and inspect it and make certain that we're holding everyone to the same standard.
All right, let's grab a couple calls here. 800-423-8255. We've got Debbie on the line from Lowell. Debbie, what's your reaction?
So, excuse me, my initial question was, you know, if this is true type thing, but if, like you're saying, he got divorced because of this, I can't say, you know, knowing people that are, you know, been victims to any type of violence that, you know, from their partner or whatever, should definitely not have that type of job. I mean, how can you tell somebody else, you know, oh, you shouldn't do this if you've done it yourself?
All right. Thanks, Debbie. And let's add one more. Alana from Watertown. Alana, go ahead.
Hi, my name's Alona.
Alona, sorry.
My question is, why You stated that Officer White, people knew that he had these domestic abuse allegations against him, and his gun was surrendered. Why was he still allowed to be an officer who carried a weapon, and what does this mean? Are there other officers who have domestic abuse charges against them? Are they still allowed to be, you know, officers and carry on with their work?
Thanks, Alona.
A statistic is 40% of police officers are domestic abusers.
So, Alona, I don't know that statistic. I don't know where that came from. And I do want to just point out, this is an allegation from 1999. So there could have been any number of steps that the police department may have taken at that time that would be different than now. Deb, yes, please do.
Yeah. I'm just happy to jump in on that because we should say the restraining order was eventually vacated, right? So the conditions of it no longer applied. So then he could carry his gun and he could go back to his marital home, see his children. So that was eventually vacated. And she's right. There's a high percentage of police officers who have been accused of domestic violence. I've seen different studies. I spoke with some attorneys about this earlier today. Usually most studies say about 25%. And again, as Marie St. Fleur pointed out, these were accusations, right? And he was not charged with a crime. So, but we don't know how it was handled within the police department. And that's really the issue.
So I want to ask Marie, there will be an investigation. It will come up with findings. Is there a path back for Commissioner White, regardless of the findings? He only served for 7 days. There will most likely be a new mayor. Is this a situation where there's any outcome that gets resolved where Commissioner White is long-term the commissioner of the Boston Police Department?
I mean, I don't know. I honestly don't know, because I don't know if this was a long-term appointment or a short-term appointment. I do think that now that they're talking about an independent investigation, I say, okay, open the windows. Don't just open the doors and do a full investigation and make certain that we take care of the matter. And perhaps in that investigation, we might learn more, right? Because right now, the voice that we're hearing is the voice of the alleged victim who filed the restraining order. The restraining order was vacated, and this occurred in the midst of what appears to be a contentious divorce proceedings. So that there are a lot of extenuating circumstances that we don't know about, which we're now commenting on, you know, 21 years later. So that hopefully, whatever the investigation is, it will reveal. But again, my concern is that we're talking about this 21 years later, and there's been opportunity, whether when he was appointed deputy, he's been in leadership for a while, and that never created an issue. So we have captains, we have patrolmen, we don't know. So the question is, are we going to take a systemic look at this issue? Are we simply going to take a look at what happened here 21 years ago and say, okay, we've elevated it, now he's gone, and then we go back to business as usual? And that is my concern with the way that this whole piece was presented. I think there's a level of unfairness that concerns me on the way this was handled.
So I do want to note, one of our producers pulled some information. This is from an article in The Atlantic in 2014 that says, quote, two studies have found that at least 40% of police officer families experience domestic violence, in contrast to 10% of families in the general population, end quote. Mm-hmm. So, Deb Becker, I'm putting you on the spot here. You may not be able to answer this question. You know, we're, 15 hours into this. What do we know about how an investigation will unfold in this case?
Well, all we know at this point, Yeah, I mean, we don't know, really. It's not every day, obviously, that something like this happens. We just know that the city has announced who it's retained to begin looking into this. When we've had other issues in the state and there have been independent investigations, typically folks are very close-lipped about those for a long time. An attorney will gather all the various parties together, probably have a team of folks working and asking people, collecting documents, and then we'll put together some sort of an investigatory report, and the city will decide what to do from there. I mean, that's, you know, but otherwise in terms of timeline and more specifics than that, I don't think we know. But I wonder, you know, if I may ask Marie St. Fleur, I just wonder, not so much about this specifically, but does this mean at a time when police reform is so much at the forefront, doesn't this suggest that perhaps there needs to be a different process in choosing a new commissioner? I mean, shouldn't it be open to more people? Should it just be a mayoral appointment? Or do you think that this incident will make changes in the way the next commissioner is named?
And so, again, I think we were looking at I'm thinking of this as an interim, this particular as an interim action, and I don't know that for a fact, so I'll state that. But I will also direct folks to the Boston police reform that we worked on this summer, where that act, that issue was raised as well. And we suggested that, you know, that the OPAT should have an opportunity to comment on hirings. And so I don't know that it will necessarily change overall. I think that an executive should have the right to change, to select their cabinet. I think the issue here is there is a consistent issue within the police department, which is why we sat at the table around transparency and accountability. The issue of domestic violence is I think is one that we discussed around the table, and the concerns around domestic violence and how it's handled and how it's reported. Those were issues that were wrestled with. And in fact, if you take a look at the report, it is one of the recommendations that's highlighted there, and one of the regulations we submitted. So should there be more opportunity to impact the pool? Absolutely. But I do believe that an executive has the right to select their cabinet.
All right, we're going to have to stop there. That was Marie St. Fleur, a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. She was a member of the Boston Police Reform Task Force, and WBUR's own Deborah Becker reporting there. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
We have talked a lot on this show about Massachusetts vaccine rollout, especially lately, how the sign-up system is clunky at best, how the state lags behind others in overall distribution. Right now, the CDC says the Bay State ranks 13th from the bottom of states in vaccine distributions by population. But Connecticut, interestingly, is 6th from the top. So is the nutmeg state really that much better at rolling this out? What gives? Let's ask two veteran reporters. First, we have our own WBUR's Martha Biebinger and John Dankosky, who is a reporter and host of the podcast Steady Habits from the Connecticut Mirror in Hartford, Connecticut. They have both been reporting on vaccine distribution. Both are on the line now. Welcome to the show, Martha. John?
Thanks so much
for having me.
Great to have you. So, Martha, I'm going to start with you, and I am just going to say, Martha, what gives? Are we as bad as the rankings suggest?
Well, here are the numbers, Tiziana. Mass has injected about 60% of the doses delivered. Now, some of those are appropriately in storage for people who are in line for their second dose, but Governor Baker said yesterday he is not happy with where we are in this rollout. He was unapologetic, though, for some of the reasons for it, some of the decisions his administration made early on.
The decision we made to vaccinate straight out of the gate hospital workers, the decision we made to organize and structure a very significant and complicated outreach program to congregate care providers, and the decision we made to choose to be focused early on homeless people, who would not necessarily be part of the rollout in many other places, I think we did the right thing there. But I get the fact that that meant other people needed to wait. And I'm not satisfied with where we are.
Now, I might just, with a nod to my buddy John, I might just say there's a lot of critique of these rankings as well, because some healthcare leaders who focus on getting vaccines to people of color and some of those underserved populations that the governor was just talking about, we know those people have been at greater risk for infection, hospitalizations, and deaths. These leaders say that if you're going to speed up, you're going to vaccinate people who are the easiest to reach, and those are more likely white people than people of color. And so if you shift to speed for just focusing on speed, you may well end up with even greater inequities due to COVID, meaning more people of color getting sick and dying.
Okay, there's a lot there, but because you gave that nod to what it says on paper and to John, I'm going to turn to him for a second, because John, CDC, Bloomberg, Johns Hopkins, their metrics put Connecticut high in the rankings, but optics and reality can be different. So is Connecticut where it looks like it is, and are residents satisfied with the rollout?
Well, right now, I think the governor, Ned Lamont, has been pretty satisfied indeed. He says that we're in a race. Now, when he talks about a race, it's not necessarily against Massachusetts or any other state. He's been trying to get the vaccine into the arms of as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, because he's very concerned, as we all are, about the variants that have been showing up in various places in the U.S. and certainly other places around the world. At this point, Connecticut has basically prioritized speed. They've said, we're going to get this into the arms of course, healthcare workers first, but also those 75 and older. And one of the things that the governor has told us is that's just the most efficient way to get the most doses out to people. What Martha talks about is very true. The Connecticut Mirror did an analysis of the population of the state and how exactly this breaks down. And what we found is that 84% of the people 65 and over in the state of Connecticut are white. That compares to about 66% in the overall population. What that means is that an awful lot of people who are 55 and over, who are Black, who are at much higher risk of morbidity from this disease, aren't going to get vaccinated as quickly. So that really is the flip side, and that's the rub. Do we want to do this fast and get it out to as many seniors as possible, or do we want to put more younger priority groups first? And Connecticut's kind of made its choice there.
Oh, there's so much I wanted to get to on that. Let's piece it out. So, Martha, I'm going to come back to you for a second. We've got this setup of sort of speed and efficiency tends to equal white. Governor Baker has made strong statements that we were slower in the beginning on purpose to reach more vulnerable people. But there have been logistical challenges in and of themselves. Is what Governor Baker said sufficient to explain the ways that we lag?
Well, no, you're right. There are definitely logistical challenges. You know, there were too many doses going to nursing homes where only about 50% of the staff wanted them. Universities and clinics, in some cases, got more than they needed and were sitting on them until eligibility groups opened up. You know, you mentioned the clunky registration websites at the beginning. And of course, the big overriding factor is this unpredictable supply and figuring out where to send it on short notice when the administration figures out how much it's going to get. Of course, the Biden administration is promising to speed that up. But I might just say one more thing, if you don't mind, about age and race, because I had a compelling conversation with a doctor last week who she works in Lynn, which is a largely minority community, very hard hit by COVID. She said, you know, don't live to 75. So when you start phase two, which Massachusetts has done at age 75, you're essentially prioritizing whites.
All right. So that obviously is the front and center question in this moment. John, Martha, I'm gonna open it up to the two of you to talk to me and to each other. What are Connecticut and Massachusetts doing to address those access issues? And when does speed stop being the driving factor if speed equals white people are going to get vaccinated?
John. Well, one thing I'll say, we've talked to the governor about this, and he's very concerned, too. And I don't want to make this sound like Connecticut does not believe that this is a problem. They absolutely do. Governor Lamont has addressed this concern over and over again. It's why frontline essential workers are part of this phase 1B. Essentially, these are folks who are largely Black and brown residents of Connecticut who work in some of these frontline places like grocery stores that need to stay open. These are people who are in the 1B group. They just happen to be coming in after those 65 and over. But the governor has said we are prioritizing them. The other thing that the state has done really well in the last couple of weeks, honestly, since nosy reporters like us started asking a bunch of questions about it, is they really have beefed up the phone system, something that was pretty clunky early on for people to register for their vaccines. And they've also done a much better job as far as doses used. We had been questioning these numbers that you see on the CDC site when Connecticut was doing very well in terms of vaccinating a percentage of the population, but not terribly well as far as getting total number of doses into the arms of people they have available. That number's risen quite a bit from around 60-some percent to 76% in just the last week or so. So it seems as though Connecticut has made a priority recently of trying to solve some of these clunkiness issues for seniors to get appointments, and also just to make sure that they're more concerned about using the doses they've got as opposed to just the overall number of the population that is getting vaccinated.
So, Martha, throwing it back to you, and hopefully in your response, you can give us a little bit about that phone system.
Yeah, the phone system has been a big problem. There's an effort to open a phone bank that will hopefully help seniors sign up more quickly. The larger equity response in Massachusetts is focused on geography. It's focused on the hotspots where people have shown they're most likely to be infected, hospitalized, and die. And so that means more vaccines to pharmacies in those areas. It means more vaccines to the community health centers that serve those areas and to the local health departments in those cities and towns.
So, Martha, to that point, we know that the Biden administration has announced it's going to start sending more doses over and above what goes to states to private pharmacies. How fast do we think that could make a difference?
I don't know about how fast it will make a difference in the rates for race or distribution overall, but there is a prioritization in some of those hotspot communities for doses that are coming in through that new Biden pharmacy initiative.
Excellent. And John, I heard you wanted to jump in there. We're close to time, but jump on in.
Yeah, just very quickly, I wanted to say that a couple of things that Connecticut's trying to do is find new ways to actually get people to their appointments. A lot of buses going to clinics. Uber actually worked, we believe, the first time anywhere in the country with the town of Vernon to give people Uber rides to go get their vaccines. This is something they want to pilot around the rest of the country. In other parts of the state, they're talking about paramedics going out and getting high-risk seniors at home. So we're trying a lot of things to make this system work a little bit better and more efficiently where people are.
And Martha, in our last 30 seconds, what's the next big challenge to address here in the Commonwealth?
The supply is the overriding issue. How fast will demand is exceeding supply many fold here. So you have to fix the ways that people are going to get their vaccine with better, more sites, more hours, easier sign up. But then you have to have the supply to meet that demand.
Wow. So helpful, the two of you. Thank you. That is WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger and John Dankosky, who is reporter and host of the podcast Steady Habits from the Connecticut Mirror in Hartford. So helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's always good to be on. Thanks.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Withman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.